Welcome to the Women in the Can competition season of the Seventh Row podcast. This is the first of four weekly episodes, which will be released between now and June 1st. This year is the first year that Can has put five films directed by women in competition, although technically one of those is co-directed by a man, so does it really count? But anyway, that's more than any previous year. They are still far from gender parity, but we wanted to take this opportunity to celebrate the wonderful women filmmakers and their films that have been feted by the competition and elsewhere in Cannes, both this year and in the past at Cannes. I'm your host, Alex Heaney, editor-in-chief of Seventh Row. I'm joined by my co-host, our executive editor, Orla Smith.
Hello.
And our guest, associate editor, Dr. Brett Pardee.
Hello. So here's what's coming up on the Women in Cannes competition season. In our podcast series, we will cover some of our favorite films by women that have been in the Cannes competition in the last decade. This week, we'll be talking about the history of women in the Cannes competition over the years, and in particular, how things have changed, or not, in the last decade. Next week, on May 18th, we'll talk about the exciting inclusion of Kelly Reichardt in the 2022 competition, and what this means for Reichardt's career. In 2 weeks, on May 25th, we'll talk about Celine Sciamma's history at the Cannes Film Festival, including her landmark film and competition entry, which won Best Screenplay, Portrait of a Lady on Fire. In our final episode in 4 weeks on June 1st, we'll discuss Japanese filmmaker Naomi Kawase, who has appeared in the Cannes competition more frequently than any other woman, and yet her work is still underappreciated.
To go along with this series, we have created a special box set of books that is comprised of three books that we wrote in the past that are about directors, women directors, who have at some point been in the Cannes competition. There are also three of our favourite filmmakers, Lynn Ramsey, Celine Sciamma, and from this year's competition, Kelly Reichardt. There'll be a bit more on that later, but if you want to get your copy of the Women in Cannes competition box set, you can go to 7th-row.com/women-at-cannes. Cannes spelled C-A-N-N-E-S. On today's episode, we're going to give a brief history of women in the Cannes competition over the years. So Cannes is usually seen within the industry as the most prestigious film festival and a mark of importance, yet women are rarely granted the opportunity to receive this honour. Sometimes Cannes gets it right, but for every wonderful film by a woman in competition, there are many more that the competition has overlooked and or that have been overlooked by Cannes in general in favour of Sean Penn.
or Gus Van Sant's Sea of Trees.
Oh yeah, never forget.
I think I think next we want to just explain how Cannes works, I guess. Because it's very inside baseball, even if you follow Cannes.
And you've been to Cannes, I've been Alex, to Cannes. So you're well placed to explain this.
Okay. Because it's a weird festival that has the quote-unquote official selection, then also sidebars that are separate from and yet not separate from the festival. Isn't that super confusing? It sure is. And I had no clue how it worked the first time I was at Cannes in 2014. So the thing that gets the most coverage that everybody knows about is the competition. And that is, those are the films that are selected to compete for the Palme d'Or. Those are the ones that you end up hearing the most about. They get the sort of the biggest red carpet rollout. And those are all selected by like the official Cannes committee that's been headed up by Terry Framo for far too long. But within the official selection, there are several sidebars. One of them is, that we'll talk about a fair bit today, is A Certain Regard, which is theoretically a sidebar for up-and-coming filmmakers, but sometimes people who had been in competition many times got randomly demoted to A Certain Regard for reasons, I don't know, it's who knows with Cannes. We can speculate. So that actually, all of these, both of these things, they happen in the big Palais building, which is like the center of Cannes. And there they also have out-of-competition screenings and special screenings and Cannes Classics, which is a mix of restorations and documentaries about films. So that is like what most people think of as Cannes, and that is how Cannes originally began. But in, I believe, the 60s, some people even then thought Cannes was stodgy and out of date.
yeah, 1962.
Yeah. I think that's when, I think Director's Fortnight came first, but I'm not.
It came second.
It came second, okay.
The International Critics Week started in 1962 because the French film critics were mad that only producers got to choose what was screened at Cannes.
Yeah.
And they really wanted to screen Shirley Clarke's The Connection. So I think it was interesting that it was a film by a woman that was the impetus for starting the Critics Week. And the Critics Week was also named by a critic and director who was a woman, Nellie Kaplan, came up with the term.
Huh.
And then in 1969, Director's Fortnight came in because Cannes had been canceled in 1968 because of the student protests. And the idea was that Cannes was not supporting enough sort of radical cinema.
No kidding.
And Director's Fortnight was meant to be like things that were really kind of avant-garde and challenging the conventions of cinema. I'm not sure it really still is, but...
Yeah, I don't know.
That was the intention. And like for the first couple of years of Director's Fortnight, they invited like 60 films and it was this huge sidebar. But it's it shrunk to be a bit more manageable. But also probably because there's a lot of other film festivals that have grown in scope since.
Yeah. So like the thing is that Director's Fortnight and Critics Week are independent of the Cannes Film Festival as far as like how selection works, I guess, and how they're co-run, but they're still considered part of the Cannes umbrella. So, for example, if you get press accreditation for the Cannes Film Festival, you apply to Cannes, and then this also gives you access to Director's Fortnight and Critics Week, although in the olden days when I went in 2014 and 2015, it took quite a bit of working out how that worked. And also they treated you better in the sidebars than they did in... But anyway, that's a whole other story about Cannes elitism in the press pass world. But what's sort of funny is so Cannes happens on this street in Cannes called the Croisette. And like close to the beginning of the... Like the center of Cannes, the center of the town, is where the Palais de Festival is, which is where the main competition and the official selection happen. And then you have to keep walking further down the street to get to the sidebar. So Director's Fortnight is like a 10-minute walk down the Croisette. And then to get to Critics Week, it's like another 10 minutes down the Croisette. So, and these streets are filled with people. Like you can't walk at a normal pace. You have to deal with crowds. So if you want to see those films, like you got to work for it compared to everything sort of just being centrally located at the Palais, which I think like, it's important to think geographically about where these things are, and therefore there is some sort of connection between their level of prestige or their level of considered prestige and where they're geographically located. It's worth pointing out too that Critics Week, I think it's only for the first two, maybe three feature films that a director has made.
It's supposed to be the first two.
First two, okay. I think they might make some exceptions with their like special with their special screenings, but they're to get awarded anyway, it's only the first two, and so it's deliberately a new filmmaker section, whereas Director's Fortnight programs tons of first films, but they also have tons of people who have made lots of films. And so I guess we'll get into this, but I think what we'll end up just the sort of preview is that actually the programming in the sidebars is pretty exciting and often better than the competition, because the competition has other kinds of politics of who is going to look hot in a photo shoot and various things like that that the sidebars are less concerned with when programming.
And what's unsaid there is that they also feature more women.
Yes.
I think kind of as a result of what you just said, that they are more they have more interesting programming, and I think they're more concerned with whether the film is good than they are whether it has massive stars, because, well, the films with massive stars tend to go to competition anyway.
Yeah, and you don't, to get into, if you are a woman director, to get into a sidebar, you don't have to be a hot famous actress or a really rich person or the partner or child of a, you know, famous person who is previously can-fetted. Now, I'm not saying help.
Or a woman who has previously made 15 very acclaimed films and finally will be allowed
in. Yes, right. So, Brett put together this amazing history of women at Cannes, where you have made a list of every single feature film by women that has been programmed at Cannes across all of the sections since its inception. And so we'll put a link to this in the show notes so you can check it out, because as far as I know, no one else has ever bothered to collect this data. So it is a treasure trove, and we have been learning a lot from it. So we're going to start there and let Brett give us some of the summary of what you have learned from investigating every film ever programmed at Cannes that was directed by a woman, feature film.
Well, the original plan was to start at 2000. Well, I thought 2000 was interesting because you have two films by women in competition, then another five in In Search and Regard, two out of competition, two in International Critics Week, and nine in Director's Fortnight. So I was thinking, that seems like a decent number for 2000. So I was wondering, when exactly did how far back do we have to go before we don't find that number of women in the competition? Or not the competition, but at the festival? And really, it turns out that maybe not quite that many films, but there's not a huge difference in the number of films by women at Cannes from about the early 1980s till maybe the last couple of years. There's a slight notable improvement. But it feels like for much of the time, there's not really this linear progression of more women being invited to the festival as much as it is women have always been in film and some get invited to the festival. And you can kind of get the sense that probably the guys running Cannes are like, we seem to be doing well enough. No need to actually make any concerted effort.
This year at Cannes, there's five women in competition, which is a record number by one.
But one of those is co-directed by a man, just to be clear. Yeah. So,
like, one thing I always wonder is, are things actually improving, or are they just getting more focus and, like, more media attention where they claim they're improving, but they haven't actually done much to change? And this feels like a case of that. So, like, you go back to, like, 1993, you have Free Women in Competition, another five in In Certain Regard. Like, that wasn't typical of the 90s, but it also, like, it did happen. Whereas I feel if they had that level now, they'd make a big deal. Oh, look how well we're doing. And Cannes was early to give a woman the Best Director award. Yulia Slonseva won in 1961. They never invited her back for her subsequent films, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. Yeah, I think the other thing is the thing that's really not changed is the competition. I think in the last few years anyway, the Critics Week and Fortnite have made more of a concerted effort to hit gender parity. And they're a lot closer to it. It's not as stark, at least in the last couple of years. I would say like 6 years ago, it wasn't really any different than it was 20 years ago.
And I learned looking back through the various sidebars that a film's reputation really does not matter where in Cannes it debuted. That there's a lot of years where the competition films are stuff that people don't really revisit, but there's stuff in Director's Fortnight in particular, which are kind of that went on to be the most influential and critically and academically acclaimed films of that year.
Yeah, and I mean, the flip side of that is that the competition is programming is a bit unimaginative, like, because it's so much about who's going to be on the red carpet and who must we, you know, oh, the Dardennes have a new film, we must have it in competition. And so then that means, you know, some new exciting film gets kicked out.
Which is a bit strange, because it's not like the Dardans are the most glamorous of filmmakers.
No, yeah. Well, you know, they have their list of... Well,
I think them and Ken Loach are kind of the political alibi of Cannes. It's look, we have we'll always program these directors who are making, you know, politically engaged films, and it makes us seem like we care about society.
It's how we get away with Grace of Monaco.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, yes, this is a lavish celebration of wealth, but... Yeah, we give Ken Loach the Palme d'Or actually on a fairly regular basis because
yeah, the Dardans too.
Working class. Yeah, the Dardans too. It's like we recognize working class people have problems. Anyway, back to the glamour.
Yeah, I mean, also Cannes it seems very stark, like this idea of Cannes refusing to acknowledge women in competition, because Cannes is also a place that is like known to really, really prize the idea of the auteur.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really important idea in their programming, even more so than other festivals where like Cannes kind of prizes this idea of like the director being this genius visionary behind the films, and the director as kind of a celebrity, and the director as this person who you should be really interested in. And so the fact that the directors are so much like the face of their films, even more so than they are in like other elements of the film industry, that might also like point to why they haven't really recognized women, because they've not recognized sort of like women as important or as serious as faces of their films.
Yeah, and it's sometimes it seems like who they have anointed is a bit random.
They really want Jacques Audiard to be a thing.
Well, okay. Yeah, I didn't even mean the men, but that's a whole other, like...
Okay,
Has Novitius, really? We need space for him every year? My favorite thing about Audiard is that the Coens clearly hated Dipan. And if you ever watch their press conference about the awards, it's hilarious. Because they try to say without saying it that they hated the film and that they gave Best Director to the Best Film.
What was the film they gave Best Director?
I believe it was The Assassin. And they said something like, if you think about it, the director's in charge of the film, so if you get an award for Best Director, that actually means Best Film. And right. I think Ethan said of Dipan, we all had a certain level of enthusiasm for it. Yeah. But I just mean, like, you know, sometimes they do pick really fantastic women directors, but, like, why have they anointed Andrea Arnold and Jane Campion and Lynn Ramsey? And if they have a film, they'll put them in competition. But then also, like, they ignored Jane Campion for several years between giving her the Palme d'Or and putting her back in competition with Bright Star.
And like the Andrea Arnold thing is also a bit random, because she was in competition with her first film, which is a big anomaly, because Andrea Arnold was not like famous for other reasons beforehand. Like she had been an actress as a teenager, but she was not a famous actress. She was just on British TV. And, you know, that was a while ago. And so I think she won an Oscar for her previous short film. But a lot of it does seem a little bit random as to why. I mean, you know, I don't disagree with them putting that film in competition, Red Road, but it's strange. I wonder how these decisions are made. It's a bit, it's like a mishmash of so many different things.
Because you look at the films, a lot of the films in competition, and you think, yeah, that was a great film. So it's not like I begrudge that. But then on the other hand, you look at, like, if you think about some of, in my opinion, our opinion, maybe even wider opinion, some of like the most influential or prolific women directors of the last 40 years, they're like completely absent from Cannes. Like they were there once. Mm-hmm. So you have like Gillian Armstrong, whose first feature, My Brilliant Career, was at Cannes. That put her on the map, and then never again. And then you have Agnieszka Holland, whose first feature was in International Critics Week, and then she was never to be seen at Cannes ever again. And you have a Canadian filmmaker, Patricia Rosema, big fans of her. Well, we're big fans of them all here at Seventh Row. But so her first film, I've Heard the Mermaid Singing, which actually just got a 4K re-release. It played at the director's Fortnite, and then she never screened another film at Cannes again.
Mira Nair won the Camera d'Or in 1988 and never screened another film.
There you go. And yet, I mean, and those are all side, a lot of that is sidebars, but then it's like the Cannes comp.
Yeah, she was in director's Fortnite.
But, you know, the Cannes competition, as you put it, while we were planning out this episode, they've made space for 3 Adam Egoyan films in the last 20 years. How hard would it be to make space for some women?
Yeah.
The weirdest one to me is definitely Claire Denis'
debut.
It was in competition in 1988, and this year is only going to be her second competition spot.
Yeah. I was amazed by that.
Completely bonkers.
And she's screened in Cannes several times in between, but always not in competition.
Yeah, Let the Sunshine In was in director's Fortnite. And Bastards was in Certain Regard.
Yeah, I think she might have had like a couple out of competition or something like that films too.
Yep.
The two other examples are like you have Agnes Varda and Chantal Ackerman.
Right.
Varda's second feature, Cleo from 5 to 7, was in competition in 1962. And then never again.
Well, and I think the key thing with those two, although it doesn't excuse the omission of their other films, is the silly thing about the competition is they only program fiction films. So if you make nonfiction films, you will not be in competition, even if you are a Cannes darling. So, for example, Andrea Arnold, who's always in competition pretty much, she made the documentary Cow last year, and that was, they still wanted her because they want to own her image. They put her in Cannes Premiere, and Sergei Lajnita, he has made some fiction films, which have, he's a man, obviously, has made some fiction films that have been in competition, but he makes a ton of documentaries, and then they screen them in, like, out of competition or special screenings or whatever. But the
documentaries aren't real movies.
Right, exactly. And then you have people like Frederick Wiseman, who screens at Director's Fortnite all the time, but of course has never been, as far as I'm aware, in the official selection at Cannes. But so anyway, the point I was going to make was with Agnes Varda and Chantal Ackerman is those are filmmakers who made a lot of nonfiction film. And I mean, Varda mostly made nonfiction film. Chantal Ackerman probably about evenly split between fiction and nonfiction. So already there's going to be lots of films they aren't going to want to put in competition.
Though at least Varda got into competition once.
Right, unlike Ackerman, who made a bunch of great fiction films and never ended up in competition, which is wild.
I mean, they put The Captive in director's Fortnite.
Yeah. News from Home was there in one of the sidebars, just shortly there. Oh, I was out of competition. Yes. So after she made a splash at Director's Fortnite, then, what was this, the year later, 2 years later, then the official selection said, okay, we'll recognize your existence, but you made a documentary, so out of competition for you. Because I think to me, one of the things that was so interesting about this list was discovering, you know, as you said, Brett, that often the most important films in cinema history were actually in the sidebars. And, like, some years are particularly amazing for women, but also just generally. Like, maybe we should talk about some of the films that, where you go back through the sidebars and you're like, well, that was an amazing film. That was an amazing film. Yeah. And each time it's like, what was wrong with you, competition?
Well, look at 1975 screened Jean Dielman. It screened Hester Street, which I think was Joan McLean-Silver's first film, and India Song by Marguerite Duras.
Who walked out of Jean Dielman.
Yeah. But those are all, like, quite significant films in their own ways.
Like, very significant films that had a huge impact on filmmakers and filmmaking.
I mean, arguably, like, you know, film language would be different, very different without Jean Dielman.
Absolutely.
And that was in Director's Fortnite. Hester Street was in Critics Week, and India's Song was out of competition that year, but they were all the same year and none of them were in competition.
Yeah, we talked about this a bit on our episode on when we talked about Jean Dielman and Les Rendezvous d'Anna, but like Chantal Ackerman was informed at Cannes that she was an important director, which I guess was, and she was like, what? Which I guess is what happens when you're in Director's Fortnight, is like they program important directors, but it doesn't, it's not necessarily seen that way, even though that's what they're, they have a history of doing that. So she was like, what? I'm important now? I'm influential? What?
It's what happens if you go to Cannes. People just designate you important.
Well, that too.
Well, yeah, and that year was loaded because they all, because like if looking at the films by men and Director's Fortnight, I had Fassbinder's Fox and Friends, Theo Angelopoulos's The Traveling Players, and Tobe Hooper's The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which all went on to be very influential films in their own way. Yeah,
like hugely influential.
And then there's a bunch of other well-known directors and Director's Fortnight that maybe it's not their best films, but like that year, the Director's Fortnight is so much better than the competition. It's,
what was in competition that year?
The best films in competition that year, well, the Palme d'Or went to Chronicle of the Years of Fire, which is a Algerian historical epic. You had Michelangelo Antonioni's The Passenger, Werner Herzog's The Enigma of Caspar Hauser, King Hu's A Touch of Zen, but not really. So, like,
they're not, it's not bad films, strong year. But they're not, like,
Martin Scorsese's Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore.
It's, like, good films, but they're not, like, they changed the history of cinema films.
They're solid, but
they're not Jean Dielman.
They're not Jean Dielman.
Yeah. Or even Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like, if you want to talk about films that changed the course of film history.
Yeah, like, whereas, like, Jean Dielman is, like, inarguably, like, an incredibly influential film.
Yeah.
Like, you can't, you can't, like, walk into a film class without tripping over Jean Dielman.
We can't watch most modern, like, so many modern films have Jean Dielman influences all over them.
Well, I wouldn't say Cannes ever really has very progressive taste in terms of films that are doing something very new. They don't really like that.
Well, in competition, no, right? Because they, the best way to get into competition is to have been in competition. So how are you ever gonna,
so as much as they claim they like auteurism, they're not very supportive of people that are emerging auteurs, or even people that are like mid-career auteurs that are just doing something that's very polarizing. Like, not in a Lars von Trier polarizing way, but I'm thinking more in a, like, like, kind of a Fassbinder polarizing way.
Well, like someone who's doing something a little different. I do think it's interesting that Cannes touts itself as, like, this sort of, like, pure cinema festival, whereas, like, you have festivals later in the year that are kind of geared towards, like, award season runs where it's a little bit commercial, and you have festivals with other... But, like, Cannes is sort of, like, we are art. We are all about the art. But looking through these sort of like past lists of what was out of competition, what was in competition, you really see that they continually miss films that are doing something very important and influential and different with film language, like films that actually are enduring because of like their cinematic quality. It's really interesting to see, you know, you could argue that the films that are great in competition are kind of in, they're in competition incidentally because they're by people who were already like influential that would be good for competition, or because they had famous people in them that would be good for competition, but not necessarily because the people who programmed the competition saw it and thought, this film is important enough that we need to have it in competition because of its cinematic value.
Yeah, like even in the within the official selection, I'm just thinking. So I was at Cannes in 2014, and in 2015, and two films that played that year were Mad Max: Fury Road, which was out of competition, and Gus Van Sant's piece of trash, Sea of Trees, which was in competition. And I remember, like, the boos, because Cannes is famously press. If they don't like the film, they will loudly boo it. which is in a press screening. And they actually changed how when they do press screenings at Cannes after that year because they felt bad for Gus Van Sant having to show up on the red carpet the next day after the press had published that his film was booed in the press screening the day before. But, like, I think they like programming bad films because of the press they get.
A lot of the booing is actually good. Like, a lot of the booing is actually good films.
Well, I mean, that happens too. But
I mean, there's no real correlation between if it's booed, if it's good or bad.
No, that's true. But I guess my point was they always like to program some really terrible films. I think because they get lots of press. And often they are like, let's just put this terrible film in competition and see what press it generates. And then you have something like Mad Max Fury Road, which I honestly, because of the fact it was out of competition and was like kind of a blockbuster film, just where Cannes positioned it, I didn't expect it to be good. Like, what the hell was that doing out of competition? Why wasn't that in competition that year?
I mean, that said, it's a film that is still quite, like, enduring.
Yeah.
And definitely influential.
There's very much kind of a bourgeois sense of quality to a lot of Cannes selections of, like, oh, yeah, we need some, like, upper-class people going through some emotional problems shot in a way that's nice to look at. And, yeah, it's a solid
film. Well, and we
film.
Need some famous hot women on the red carpet.
Yeah.
Which doesn't necessarily need to be in competition, just has to happen at some point in the festival.
Yeah, it's like how they sort of, like, they see, like, artistic cinema as, like, an accessory rather than actually being interested in what the films are doing, I feel.
Yeah.
They're like, this makes us look like we are interested in the art and in the art house, but I don't see, like, the thought process necessarily of, like, I'm actually excited by what this film is doing. And there ends up a lot of the time being exciting films in competition. But I think it's because, like, they program, they pick their directors and, you know, they don't necessarily really sort of care to even watch the film. They're just like, that director, that director, that director. And often they are interesting directors. But whether the film or not is interesting is kind of incidental.
Well, and also if you're a director they like, then there's a strong possibility your film gets in without being done. Like Lynn Ramsey's You Were Never Really Here, which was finished, what, like the night before it screened?
Yes.
So, yes, that book, we wrote a book about the film, and it has some of these wild stories in it, which is in the Women in Cannes competition box set.
Yeah, we did an interview with the producer of the film, and he basically walked me through, like, the very, very wild story of how that film was made. Like, everything was last minute. It was like, oh, we have the funding to shoot next week. Okay, let's get everything together. Oh, we have to finish for Cannes, like, in a month's time when we haven't even, like, shot the whole film yet. Okay, cool. Let's just do that. It's pretty wild. We have created a special box set of books that we previously wrote about women who have featured in the Cannes competition. The Women in Cannes competition box set includes books about three women directors who've been selected for the competition over the years. There are also three of our favourite filmmakers, Lynn Ramsey, Celine Sciamma, and this year, Kelly Reichardt. Get your copy of the Women in Cannes competition box set at 7th-row.com/womenatcannes. That's C-A-N-N-E-S. On our Kelly Reichardt ebook, Roads to Nowhere, Kelly Reichardt's Broken American Dreams, Claudio Alves of The Film Experience said, as a Kelly Reichardt fan, I can't recommend Roads to Nowhere enough. On our Celine Sciamma book, Portraits of Resistance, film critic Alfred Soto commented, erudite and casual, Portraits of Resistance will force readers into running back to watch every Sciamma film to see what they missed. On our Lynn Ramsey book, You Were Never Really Here, a special issue, Brian Tallarico of RogerEbert.com wrote, Seventh Row's ebook allows for a deeper appreciation of a brilliant piece of art. It's what we want more from critical analysis, a conversation with the art and its creators, but so rarely get. Get your copy of the Women in Cannes competition box set at 7th-row.com/womenatcannes.
There's who selects the films, which you know, for the last, I don't know how many decades, is Terry Frymo and his pals. And then they select...
I actually have one question before getting into this. Does Frymo do the promotional material for Cannes, like the official poster as well?
What do you mean by does he do it?
Well, like, does he approve the final image?
Probably. Like, he's in charge.
Because, like, Cannes has really leaned into attractive actresses of the 1960s for their posters over the last 10 years.
I mean, I don't know if that could be a separate marketing team, but he's in charge of, he's at least in charge of the program. So that could, it's hard to know. But I think he also picked the jury. Like, he invites the jury.
Like, it just feels like Cannes is very much, even more so than in the past, over the last decade, focusing on the idea of glamour over...
Oh, yeah. Film. I mean, like, there are... In the two...
Like, you think that would get better, but it seems to be getting worse.
I mean, if you make a film that takes place in Cannes, you're in. Like, when I was at Cannes, I think in 2015, there was a film with Adèle Haenel, which I think is an André Tichenet film. And it was, like, a pretty good film. It also had Guillaume Canet, so, like, he was a thing then. People didn't know who Adèle Haenel was back then. But it was set in Cannes, so it screened out of competition. Like, I mean, it was a French film, so it might have gotten in there anyway, but I did think it was funny that they just, like, wanted to play a film about... like, about Cannes. And the year before that, the opening film was Grace of Monaco. So I think that feeds into your theory there.
Yeah, it's just interesting because I was making the list by going through the Wikipedia pages for that had the list of films. And on each Wikipedia page, the image is the poster for that festival. And the posters throughout the 80s and 90s are all kind of abstract, kind of emphasizing this idea of, I think they're kind of more suggestive as, like, this is art. And then it has a dramatic shift to images of famous actresses from the past. And the odd actor. It's just bizarre to me to go from a poster of, like, these fragmented images of seagulls to Jean-Paul Belmondo and Anna Karenina kissing in two separate cars.
Yeah, and there was the Ingrid Bergman.
Yeah, Ingrid. And there's one of, like, Claudia Cardinale with her skirt spinning around.
Right,
around
her and waist. There was recently there was one for that Godard film.
Contempt.
That's the one. Thank you.
Weirdly, this year is an homage to the Truman Show.
I know so. That. I thought that was so random.
Is it?
That's what it is. Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
Which was not at Cannes, for the record.
Right, which is also why, it's like, what is, why? Okay. Anyway.
It's not a film that I'd expect to be at Cannes. That's just weird, okay.
Yeah. Okay, but I did want to sort of address awards, because it's interesting how much or how little women have been recognized in awards, because the one place they do have gender parity is the jury. Now, the jury is handpicked by Terry Frymo. The jury presidents are usually men, which actually therefore means that it's not parity, because there's parity among the plebes on the jury, if we ignore the president. But, like, only two women directors have won the Palme d'Or ever.
Or one and a half, kind of.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, Jane Campion, when she got hers, she had to share it.
Yeah.
And then,
which is not a very common thing, to be clear. It's very rare that the Palme d'Or is split between two films, but for the first woman to win, it was...
Can't give it to her on her own, got to award a man as well.
And then technically two other women have won the Palme d'Or, because it was given to the director and two lead actresses for Blue is the Warmest Colour for the honour of being... abused on set.
Yeah, well, and that was the year that Steven Spielberg was the jury president, and they made this, like, actresses have never been awarded the Palme d'Or, so that was the first of its kind. And then, of course, last year Julia Ducournau is the first woman to get the Palme d'Or to herself.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you know, women do pick up other awards on occasion. Like, recently Portrait of a Lady on Fire won Best Screenplay. So did You Were Never Really Here won Best Screenplay.
Weird film to win both. Oh, and I guess like Portrait makes sense. You Were Never Really Here is a strange film to win Best Screenplay, given that it has very, that like some of it was sort of like formulated on set and it has very little dialogue.
Well, screenplay is a weird one because it's one of the awards. The only time you can give a film two awards is if one of them is screenplay, ever since Barton Fink won everything and then they changed the rules. But so, because Joaquin Phoenix won Best Actor, so it's possible that's why she got Best Screenplay, because they wanted to give something else to her.
They probably wanted to give her Director, because that is a director's film.
Yeah, but I don't know. Sometimes giving them, like, screenplay feels like a cop-out. Like, we want to award them, but we can't give them the prestigious awards.
Yeah, it's a way to give two awards sometimes.
And the grand jury prize went to The Wonders, which was the year Jane Campion was jury president.
And it's probably worth mentioning the year Jane Campion was jury president, because she had a big moment, we call it, where she made some speech when, like, in the press conference, just deriding the industry as a boys' club, when she was obviously asked questions about being the only woman to have won the Palm, and people were speculating, like, is she going to give it to a woman? Well, she didn't, but she caused quite the stir amongst the press by, like, making this statement about being at a boys' club at Cannes, which is one of the biggest boys' clubs. So, you know, people have been vocal about this problem, but Cannes only has taken recently, very little action. Yeah.
Because I remember when that happened, it was, like, radical that she was saying that. Whereas now people say it every year, but then kind of shrug and say, oh, well, I'll just watch the latest Hasnavisius and Sean Penn, because that's what Terry told me to do.
Weirdly, the first woman to be jury president was Olivia de Havilland in 1965. Oh,
that's interesting. Well, the women jury presidents are also usually women. Sorry, I said that backwards.
They're almost actresses, always actresses. Thank you. Yeah, because you've had Sophia Loren, Ingrid Bergman, Jean Moreau.
Kate Blanchett, Tilda Swinton, Isabelle Huppert.
Jane Campion's probably the only one that would be a direct. I mean, Liv Ullmann directed quite a few films, but is much better known as an actress.
Yeah, I think that was one of the reasons it was a big deal that year, because they actually picked a director who is just a director.
Why am I not surprised Sean Penn was jury president once? Yeah.
One thing probably worth addressing is that, like, it feels so almost bizarre to have this conversation, because it feels like so many other, even though, like, there are so many problems in other parts of the film industry, it feels like in other parts of the film industry we're beyond having the conversation about why more than, like, four women should be programmed in a 20, but, like, in other parts of the film industry we can have a conversation about, like, where are the women of color?
Yeah.
Where are, like, the diversity of types of women?
Why isn't, like, it, why isn't not all, even, like, rich white ladies?
Yeah, like, we've not even really gotten into that much, because, like, we still have to bug Ken about, like, can we have some women, please? Like, we'll get to, like...
And they're like, yeah, here's a couple of hot French actresses. You can have them.
Yeah. Yeah, like, we had, like, Mati Diop a couple years ago, who's a hot French actress but also is a black woman, so yay, diversity. But, like, mostly it is, like,
and a good film, like, rich white, I mean, women. Not that there aren't a lot of like, there are actually a lot of French actresses, white French actresses, who make fantastic films, so I don't want to knock it, but there are also a bunch that they just kind of throw in there all the time, and their films are, like, bad to fine. Like, there isn't an Emmanuel Bercot film that they haven't wanted to program. And she's not bad. She's fine. But she's fine. Like, her films are... I enjoy them. I watch them. They're not great.
And again, I wouldn't say the diversity thing is anything that has improved either throughout the history of Cannes. Senegalese director Safi Faye was not in competition, but in a certain regard, twice in the 1970s.
Yeah, and also just, like, geographical diversity as well, which is going to partly affect whether or not, partly, though certainly not entirely, affect whether or not you get people of color. Like, Cannes tends to program European films and is pretty bad on European and Asian films. I think they're pretty good on, but they're pretty bad on South American and African films. You know, it's not like they program none, but I remember when I was at Cannes, there was the first film ever from Ethiopia to be programmed at Cannes, which was in Un Certain Regard. It was called Lamb. I went to see it. It was good. Very poorly attended. And that was like a big deal that Ethiopia even got a film in there. And, you know, there's tons of European and Asian directors where we can say they've been at Cannes and that A, they've been at Cannes a ton of times, and B, they've been at Cannes in competition a ton of times, right? There are very few African filmmakers, we could say that about, and pretty few...
Unless they're from a country...
Right, right. Like, if they're right, like, Algerian, maybe.
Algeria, yeah. Morocco, to a lesser extent, Senegal.
We have, like, a lot of African filmmakers who are, like, from Africa but live in France now.
Yeah. I mean, they get programmed, but it's still not many of them, right? Like, I mean, and not that's not just a Cannes problem. That's all of the major film festivals in the
world. Yeah, it's not like there's any film festival. It's like, wow, you're doing a great job with African cinema.
And I think Cannes does better at putting them in competition than a lot of other festivals, at putting them in prominence. So, but anyway, that was just my brief note on the diversity that they are European, Asian, and some American.
I don't even think they don't do a very good job with women directors from Asia.
No.
Unless you're Naomi Kawase.
Like, yeah, they have no, for some reason they're like, Naomi Kawase is our woman. She's
the Jane Campion of
and,
Asia.
And we're going to program her 6 times in the last 20 years in competition, and then a couple other times in Un Certain Regard and Director's Fortnight. And yeah, that's good. We got the entire continent covered.
Yeah. Last year is a good example of how clear it is that there's not a lack of women who are willing to have their films programmed at Cannes. they just aren't being put in the competition. Because last year there were many really excellent films directed by women that were out of competition or in the Director's Fortnight or in the Critics Week or in Un Certain Regard. Whereas in the competition we had our Palme d'Or winner, Julia Ducournau, and we had Mia Hansen-Love and
we did Bergman Island. Others. Which was also her first English language film.
Yes. And so there was, and she's actually in Cannes again this year, but she is not in competition. She's in the Director's Fortnight.
Well, and Mia Hansen-Love has had films at Cannes for years. Several of her films before Bergman Island, she gave to like Berlin or to TIFF. Who knows if they were rejected first by Cannes? We don't know. But she has had a long history of being programmed by Cannes in Un Certain Regard and in Director's Fortnight. But this was the first time she was actually in competition. And I mean, it's worth stating about like how, because I think one of the big questions is how do you get into competition or how do you get into Cannes? And one of the ways you get into competition is you were in a sidebar and you made a splash. So Julia Ducournau's previous film Raw, which we loved and wrote a lot about in another book, Beyond Empowertainment. It was at Critics Week, and it was a huge success.
Did it win the Camera d'Or?
I don't know.
Oh, no, it didn't. It didn't. But it won its, I think it won its sidebar.
Okay.
It definitely won something. I just don't think it was the Camera d'Or. I think that went to Divines that year.
Oh, weird. Okay. But yeah, and then it did well at other festivals, and it was a, like, that film became a big deal. It was a film that no one expected anything from. It was in Critics Week. It was by a woman. No one it was her first feature. No one had heard of it. And then it made a big splash. And I'm sure getting Vincent Lindon in her film didn't hurt, who is the jury president this year, but then she gets into the competition. And then you have The Story of My Wife by Ildikó Ényedi from Hungary, which a film that is fine. But then the question is, like, how did that get in? Well, she won the Golden Bear at Berlin a couple years ago. And also Léa Seydoux's in that film. So that probably helped.
Didn't help Mia Hansen-Løve.
Well, no, but she was in competition the previous year. But it's like, okay, you have to win Berlin to get, if you're a woman, you have to win Berlin to get into competition.
Well, and she was in Certain Regard in 1989. I doubt they remember.
And then you have Catherine Corsini, who's been in a lot of the sidebars at Cannes before. Has she been in competition before?
Yeah, 2001, where she was the only woman in competition, unless we count Vicky Jensen's co-direction of Shrek.
And I'm a big Catherine Corsini fan, but The Divide is, like, her worst film. But it's also probably, as you mentioned, Brett, they like to occasionally acknowledge the existence of the working class. And that film does that, even though it's about rich white lesbians who encounter a working class man.
Meanwhile, we have, outside of the competition, we have films like Andrea Arnold's Cow documentary, so it doesn't exist to them, in the Cannes premiere section. We have Eva Hussein's, like, really, really interesting film, Mothering Sunday, which we talked about on our recent episodes about portraits of female artists. And her previous film, Girls of the Sun, I think it was called, was in competition at Cannes. That was her second film. And this film, it's got, like, in supporting roles, like Olivia Colman and Colin Firth and Glenda Jackson. It's got Emmy Award-winning Josh O'Connor in a big role. There's, you know, Odessa Young is, like, an up-and-coming star. And that was relegated to the Cannes premiere section, despite it being a film, like, we really like.
Well, I think we like it better than a lot of the films that were in competition as well.
Yeah, and then you have, like, The Souvenir Part 2, which is excellent, in Director's Fortnight. You have Ali and Ava, Cleo Barnard's film, in Director's Fortnight.
The thing is, Cleo Barnard has been at Cannes many times in Director's Fortnight. Or maybe not many. Selfish Giant was there in 2013, and then Ali and Ava. So this is not her first rodeo. Joanna Hogg basically hadn't been at many prestigious festivals. She basically premiered all of her films at the London Film Festival. I think one of them was at Locarno, until Souvenir Part 1 was at Sundance. It won an award, and suddenly she was a big deal. So you couple that with the fact that A24 produced Souvenir Part 2, and they have a relationship with Director's Fortnight, so I'm sure that helped barter her a position there. But it is kind of, aside from the fact that it's a sequel, which might be why the competition didn't want it, who knows? There's all kinds of backdoor deals here. But like you said, it is kind of surprising that, maybe not surprising that the competition hasn't programmed her, but it's worth noting.
Yeah, and there's, like, I mean, there's a bunch of films from last year's selection or Director's Fortnight, Critics Week, that you saw. Like Marina, for example, which won the Camera d'Or, which is a first film, although it does have, like, the producing powers of Martin Scorsese behind it, interestingly. And, I mean, you can name them. There's a myriad other very interesting films that I think, in your opinion, were as good, if not better, than a lot of the competition films.
Yeah, I mean, among, I think, the Critics Week selection especially was particularly impressive, which is, of course, all first or second features. So there were eight films. I've seen six of them, and the worst of them was quite good, just not for me, and the rest I loved. So there's Zero Fucks Given, Anaïs in Love, A Tale of Love and Desire. I was already a big fan of Leila Bouzid, who actually made a film set in one of the French African colonies.
I think it's Tunisia.
Tunisia, yeah, I think that's right. I saw her previous film and loved that. This is her second film. And A Radiant Girl, which is in fact directed by a French actress, well-known French actress Sandrine Kiberlain. But they were all fantastic. Like, those are all probably on our top 30 list of 2022. Because they will be out or are already out this year. So I think that's a pretty incredible run. And, you know, there are like two films from the competition last year that I loved. Like a few others that I would say are really good or interesting or important. And then Director's Fortnight had Ali and Ava and Souvenir Part 2. So when it comes to the movies that are really exciting, that I find really exciting, that are talking about telling interesting stories about women by women, that's happening more in greater numbers anyway, outside of the competition. I loved Bergman Island, so I don't want to short shift that. And of course, we love Worst Person in the World, about a woman, but not directed by one.
My conclusion was, don't fall for any hype that Cannes is getting more inclusive. That, based on what they've programmed in the past, it's pretty much more of the same. It's important to know as if we're in kind of like a bubble just because there's media attention on it and they will go back to their usual operating process, or if continued pressure on them will actually lead to more representation. Also, this list is also a good place to try and dig up a lot of older films by women that have kind of disappeared, that I learned about a lot of directors that I really know very little about from putting this list together, like a woman from Quebec, Anne-Claire Poirier, who was in Director's Fortnight in 1969, International Critics Week in 1976, and In Search and Regard in 1979. I don't really know her work, but it's interesting that Canadian woman was at Cannes three times in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great resource that we will put on the site in the show notes. We'll link to it.
Also kind of a sad list because you realize how many women just never got many opportunities beyond their first or second film.
Yeah.
All these careers of like what could have been.
I mean, also the flip side too, okay, it's great that you're discovering films that you haven't heard of, but for me...
good luck finding them.
Well, okay, that too, but also for me, the depressing thing was how many of them I've seen or heard of, or both. Because if you go to, like, They Shoot Horses, say, right, and look at their, like, list of 10,000, or what is it, 1,000 influential films, like, okay, first of all, most of them aren't by women, but, like... I've probably seen a better percentage of the women at Cannes history than I've seen from that list. And that's because I made a slight effort to see films by women, which tells you how few there are.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, that being said, I mean, I think we are excited that, like, I think certain women directors that we have been fans of for some time are at least... whether they have had some history with Cannes or none, I guess they've all had some, they're starting to be feted. Like, we wrote a book on Joanna Hogg and on her first Souvenir film, and then the second one was at Cannes. And we've written books on three women directors who have been in competition at Cannes, with the third being Kelly Reichardt, who's in competition for the first time this year. So, I mean, I think... we do want to continue to at least celebrate the women directors who have been at Cannes and in the Cannes competition. And so if you would like to do that and discover more about these filmmakers who tend to get less attention, you can get the 7th Row Women in Cannes competition box set. And the box set includes three critically acclaimed books that are each focused on a woman director who has been selected in the Cannes competition. And actually, I guess two of them have won awards because they've already screened. Lynn Ramsey, where we talk about her film You Were Never Really Here, which won two awards at Cannes. And Celine Sciamma, whose Portrait of a Lady on Fire screened in competition and also won Best Screenplay. And then we've got Kelly Reichardt, where our book covers everything up to and including First Cow and her process. And now her new film is in competition and we have our fingers crossed for her. And all three books, they are the first books ever written that actually explore the filmmakers' processes. So they include interviews with the filmmakers themselves, but also their collaborators, and give you a really strong, some times 360 or almost 360 degree look at how they make films, which I think is especially something we don't talk enough about when it comes to women directors. They are also non-academic, which means they're super fun and readable and are a really great way to think about the filmmakers, get excited about watching or rewatching their earlier films, and have a handy guide to help you think through them. So start the Women in Cannes celebration today. Support women, us, who are women studying women making movies, and become an expert yourself on their films with the 7th Row Women in Cannes competition box set, which you can get at 7th-row.com/womeninCannes.
So next week on the podcast, we'll be continuing our four-part series on women in the Cannes competition. We'll be focusing on Kelly Reichardt, who's one of the women in this year's competition. We're huge Kelly Reichardt fans. As we've said, we've written a book on her work that's available on the Women in the Cannes competition box set. Her new film, Showing Up, which is in competition, is her 8th feature, but it's her first feature to be in the Cannes competition. And I think her second feature to play at Cannes, yeah. I believe Wendy and Lucy played. Do you know what?
South Africa.
Yeah, it's an interesting milestone in her career. We're going to talk a little bit about her as a filmmaker and what this competition slot means for her in the context of her career. And then that's on May 18th. And then in 2 weeks' time, on May 25th, we'll be focusing on another woman who has previously screened in the Cannes competition, Celine Sciamma, and particularly her film Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which was the film that she won the Screenplay Award for at Cannes that year in 2019. So we'll be, talking about her significance. And then in the final week on June 1st, we will be discussing Naomi Kawase, who, as we talked about on this episode, is one of the few women that Cannes will consistently program in the competition.
And also one of the most consistently programmed filmmakers, period, right, Brett?
Yeah, in the last 20 years, she's been there 6 times, and the only people with more are Ken Loach's been there 7, and the Dardanes have been there 8.
Wow, okay.
So she's tied with Paolo Sorrentino and Nuri Bilge Ceylan for 6 times.
So she is the woman of Cannes, which we are going to close out our series with.
Yeah.
If you want to keep up with our, you know, if you want to check out the show notes, look at the list of the Women at Cannes history, go to our website, 7th-row/womenatcannes, where you'll find all of the content relating to our month-long celebration of Women at Cannes. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at 7th Row, SEVENTHROW, where we will be posting little facts about the history of women at Cannes, among other things, including, I guess, our coverage of past films by women that have screened at Cannes. So if you enjoyed this first episode of our season on Women in Cannes, we would love it if you would rate and review the episode. We'd also love to hear from you if you want to send us an email, contact@7th-row.com. That's SEVENTH-ROW.com.
And just to reiterate that point, we've got a lot of really interesting stuff to come in the next 4 episodes. So if you've enjoyed this episode and you're excited for the rest of the season, please do share this episode on social media. Tell people about this season if you're excited about it, because we are excited to discuss Women at Cannes.
And we'd like to hear more about it, more generally, as yes. Brett has said that, not enough has changed, and we want that conversation to at least be at the forefront this year. Otherwise, we will hopefully be in your listening devices next week, and thank you for listening.